Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 15th, 2003. Today's session is entitled, Why Are We Using Religious Language to Talk About the Economy? Session 2 of Capitalism, the New Age Religion, with Yetta Odgaard-Nash, number NAJ 2003-02. Let's listen in.
Some of you were here yesterday and some of you are new. I'm Yetta Odgaard-Nash. I'm Danish and I've been in Brazil for 3 years and I work with liberation theology and especially the line of critique of capitalism. And part of that is how liberation theologians in Brazil and Latin America as a whole criticize the language in which economists talk about their economic model, capitalism. I was thinking yesterday when I went home, how in the world am I going to make the jump from the discussion yesterday to talking about economy in a religious language, but I'm just going to just skip through a whole lot of my notes, which I just put down yesterday because the discussion was so good, and just start where I sort of planned to start. If there's anything people want to bring up from yesterday, if we can wait a little while and we can take that discussion up again. It was a lot of fun. When we talk about why would anyone want to talk about economy in a religious language?
What kind of religious language is used?
I'm going to come back to that. We never really reached that yesterday, so I'm going to come with a couple of examples from the theologians of what they see as a theologization or something of economy. I'll be back to that. I want to start with a quotation from Robin Tolmach-Lakoff, linguist from the University of Berkeley. She's written a book called The Language War, which I recommend. It's really interesting. And the quotation is, language is and has always been the means by which we construct and analyze what we call reality. The pundits opine that economy wins and loses the elections, but who actually encountered, touched, or smelled an economy? What we know of it, we know through carefully selected words, images that tells us what we ought to think and believe we know. And it's from the book Language, where she's written several books also on gender, language, and inclusive language. But this is her last. I'm not going to go into the debate whether or what politicians are saying about economy. I'm just going to skip right to The Economist. But I use the quotation to show that we create our reality through the words we use to describe it. Reality is not a given, in my opinion. It's something we create. So when we have the image of an economist, that's why we talked about who is an economist yesterday, to have sort of, we have images of different fields and the people that represent the different fields. So when we talk about an economist as a person whose job it is, or her job is to use rationality, objectivity, scientific methodology to reach the result that tells us which economic model that would be the best for our society to use. Where do we get these images from? Who has created the image of the economist in our mind? It's questions like this that I think are important to ask ourselves when we reflect about how important are the leading economists, for example, in the United States. They pretty much help dictate a great part of our life, how much we're to save, how we're going to deal with our private economy, the bigger society economy. So it has a lot to do with our lives. So we should reflect about who are these people and why do we give them this much power and be honest in our image of those people. You can ask yourself, who has the interest in creating this image of an economist? Does, for example, my Danish prime minister have an interest in creating a certain image of his economist? Isn't it his advantage to that I think about the economists that he uses that, oh, they're very rational, they only use math, they look at facts? Or is it to the advantage that I think, oh, here's a subject, a person with personal ethical values, definite particular political stance? Should I be aware of that when I listen to an economist talk? And this is what the liberation theologians ask themselves. Who are these people and how are we affected by the way that they talk? So there may be more to an economist than mere rationality. For example, when Hayek and Fukuyama, as we talked about yesterday, talk about capitalism as a given, the model for our time, because they pretty much, Fukuyama finishes off in his book, The End of History and the Last Man. He goes through, well, communism, no, failed, out with that. Socialism, no, next, you know. He takes all the models that we've known, and he, as Fukuyama, the person, has some logic about why they failed and puts them in the litter box. And so we end up with capitalism, and that is a given. He talks about it in terms of Hegel. That is part of nature. If we were bound to arrive at this point at some point. Sorry. And if we turn to the theologians that we barely got started on yesterday, to look at their critique of the present economic model, capitalism, or neoliberal free market, and the way it's being presented to us, a critique of the reality that's being, or it's a, they have a critique of the reality that's being created in the chosen presentation of this model. And I have some quotations. The first I want to talk about is Jung Musung, the professor, he's a professor of theology at two universities in Sao Paulo. And we already talked about why should theology engage in an economic discussion. And not that we're anyway done in the discussion of why should theology address an issue as economy, but we'll see. Maybe an hour is longer than I planned, but we can come back to that. He says, because the structuring of capitalism is an idolatry of the market, it is of theological importance. What it says directly and indirectly about human beings is contrary to the Christian idea of humans created in the image of God, each with a unique value in their mere being. This was what we talked about yesterday. So here's a couple of examples what he sort of arrests the economist for saying. He says, in the secularization process, the eschatological hope was transferred to a reachable possibility. The content of hope was transformed according to the ideas of the free market philosophy. Hope is no longer salvation and reunion with God. It is now fulfillment of all material desires. The modern myth is that all our desires can be fulfilled. Central is in Sung's work that with secularization, we did not leave the religious life behind. Maybe this is more relevant to a European, I'm not quite sure about it. Instead, we have now a new secularization, and he says, a mere change of myths. We have, within the religious structure, we have taken out the religious, our Christian or whatever religion content, and put in economic content with a religious sort of cover. He talks about, for example, paradise as have been dislocated from the transcendental postmortem to a future within history. It has to do with the fulfillment of all desires, which are now, according to Sung, being presented as material. And through the technological progress, we have the notion of a limitation for human achievement has now ceased to exist. We're pretty much able to fulfill ourselves. through technological progress, which this is especially directed towards Francis Fukuyama, which his prime target, I can reveal. And he has a lot about technology and how we, through technology, have reached so much further, and we're getting very close to being sort of our own procreators. And another concept in the form, informing the cult of the market, which he calls it, is original sin. He says that all ideologies or religions, also neoliberalism takes part in the diagnosis of the fundamental causes of the social problems that we encounter. That is, the fundamental evil, or in religious terms, the sin, that is the origin of other evils. One of the Bible texts which treat this theme is the myth of Adam and Eve, and the Christian theology calls this original sin. Not in the chronological meaning of the term original, but in the logical meaning. That is, we're not only treating the first sin committed in history, but also the sin that is the base of all other sins. This definition comes very important when he turns to original sin in the cult of the market. And he says, the neoliberal explanation to why we have not yet reached the promised paradise satisfaction of all is that the root of evil, the continuing intervention of the free forces of the market. Does anyone recognize this? Come back to me just to see what I mean. Keeps us from reaching it. That is, as long as we do not resist the urge to do good, political, economical, and social interference and control, we will not have perfection. The basic truly good force...
Excuse me, will you say that again?
Yeah. Okay. As long as we do not resist the urge to do good, and doing good in this economic term is, or this pseudo-good, is that we keep interfering. For example, in my country, Denmark, he says about Denmark that the reason that Danes cannot have fulfillment for their citizens is that they keep hindering the free market. They keep saying, oh, well, no, the hospital system should be public. No, we need taxes so that we can give money to unemployed people, and old people can still live in their houses and maybe even get help to pay the electricity bill. We keep making hindrances. We keep putting taxation on companies so they have to help paying for everybody's needs. And unless we lose that urge to do good, we will not reach paradise. Because this model, the capitalistic model, you have to leave alone. It has to work on its own terms. And we have to stop interfering with it. Have any of you heard this logic? Like reading newspapers or...
Yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. The foundation for almost all of this was laid a long, long time ago by Jacques Ellul. A current book that really goes into it in some depth is Marva Dawn's book, Powers, Weakness, and the Tabernacling of God, which you may have read.
Powers, weakness,
and her question is pertinent in that these statements, I guess you could call them, coming from the purveyors of capitalism are big lies because they're contradictory to everything that comes out of true theology or out of biblical theology or from God.
And you had a comment?
I just didn't hear the whole title. Powers?
Powers, weakness, and the tabernacling of God.
The tabernacling of God. Thank you.
So when I say, for example, privatization, does that,
mm-hmm.
to you, does that link up with this?
Reaganomics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Trickle down.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we have to privatize the postal system. I don't know what was privatized here in Denmark. They're selling off the train system. Everything needs to be privatized because it will work better. Except that the trains never leave and it costs twice as much.
With devastating results.
We experienced that with Amtrak in the United States.
Well, they talk about privatization, but they are willing to subsidize the private company rather than have it.
I think privatization happens when the public can't afford to pay for it. I mean, I think that's what happens. It's a way to, instead of raising taxes, it's a way to spare the budget. Because I see that in California with the freeways.
And lower wages.
Yeah, they just, I think it's primarily because the government can't afford to pay for it any longer, so they try to find a way to make it work.
There's a difference between being able to afford it and prioritizing it, though, I think.
Sure.
And we have enough money to afford a lot of stuff here.
Yeah. But I mean, that just seems, I mean, well, it's a matter of priorities.
And I would, of course, come back to who benefits from the public transportation system?
Yeah.
Why would we have an interest in cutting that out of the budget?
It depends on who you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's freeways and people who drive or mass transit or buses.
I mean, I think, maybe I should just be honest. Everybody knows where I come from, right? My political views are not exactly the same in this room.
You can come from a different, anybody that's traveled in Europe and then traveled in the United States, you can't compare the two.
No, it's very different.
It's very different because you can use mass transit in Europe and you've used it all your years. We didn't build mass transit, we built mass freeways.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an near impossible situation now to go to the European model because of our freeway situation.
Sure, and I think, have any of you read the Fast Food Nation?
Yes.
And I think it also talks about how there was a deliberate politics of eliminating public transportation. That was very interesting. I've never really understood that. A story about the difference between European and American transportation was that last year I spent 2 months in St. Paul. And they have quite a good transportation system, I think, for an American city, of course. Well, Chicago is better, but. And I wanted to go to a store in a mall on one side of the road, and Peter and the kids wanted to go to a cinema theater on the other side of the road. It was not a highway, but it was a big road. And I said to them, they had the car, and I said, you know, I'll just meet you over there afterwards. You know, it's 2 minutes on foot, I'll just walk over there afterwards. And I finished my shopping, and I thought, okay, I better head over there, and the movie might be done. And I couldn't walk over there. I tried, you know, here, and I walked back, and I tried to find another way to pass the road, and I had to take a bus. and it was like, take the bus to cross the road. It was just really disheartening.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure it makes sense. Everybody has at least one car, and if you don't, you're probably not walking.
Ma'am, are we saying, we talked about privatization versus public as kind of enemies of one another?
No, I'm just trying to say that we're given often the, in my opinion, I mean, all I say is pretty much, you know, that we don't have a choice, that we need to privatize, otherwise our economy will collapse or it will not function. We will not reach what we really want to reach, which is everybody's consumer happiness.
I think where the success in that works, that you need both. I know I worked on a campus for 40-some years and worked with state school. But we found that the state could run some things very well and do some things very well. And there was a lot of things that we couldn't do very well because private industry could do much better. They had freedoms that within certain things you don't have freedoms. Like roads, for instance, I think are best owned by the state or the federal, you know, and they can run it that way. But the work they do on those roads is done by private. And that's a pretty good marriage. I think that's pretty much a good situation. I don't think that should change.
I'm just saying that often when we're presented for the economic outline, that's not what they want to hear. That's not what the message they want to send out.
Yeah. I think in the press and in general, there's very little advocacy for the fact that we need a government. I think there's more of an advocacy that less government is more important. And there's very few voices saying, you know, I'm really glad that there's an FAA and that there's inspections of airplanes, and I'm really glad that there's these things where the government really does well, because I think that the mythology has moved the other direction, that less government, less interference, less taxes is seen as floating everybody's boat and you know, doing those kind of things. So I think that you're absolutely right. I think a mix of the two is
there's a check and balance.
There's a check, and you know that there's some things that are done better by government.
But I think if we got too much government control and too much the government was handling, you'd get top heavy, and then you wouldn't have balance anymore. I think the less government you can have, as long as you've got some control and regulations to govern some of the other things, but it shouldn't be top heavy.
And see, that's where I think we begin to have, you know, a more honest debate, because I think that there's probably a larger role for the disenfranchised and the poor and the people who don't have access to education and health and all those things. And, you know, to take this up just a slightly different way, you know, we went over and looked at the pictures the other day at the the disenfranchised South American nations, and we look at the idea of forgiving the debt. But one of the things that the International Bank requires is a restructuring of the economies in those nations, according to the mythological model that says that privatization is the primary model. There's very little role for the government when they say, you know, you owe us, you know, $700 billion, and in order to, you know, work out a deal with us, you have to do these things inside your country.
And I think that's a large part of what the third world countries are unhappy about, is that things that are okay for us to do here in the U.S. is not allowed by the World Bank and the IMF for the third world countries to do. Very good book I mentioned yesterday, Globalization and Its Discontents by Joseph Stiglitz, deals exactly with this. Who is allowed to do what, and how much power does the World Bank and the IMF have over third world country economies?
And what is it that is good for the nation? I worked with a group from Nicaragua for a long time, and in order to have funds from the international funds, then they had to sign contracts about what they were going to do. It was things like building highways and big, like office buildings. I'm so simplifying this, but big office buildings in Guatemala and in Nicaragua. I mean, and then that was to be repaid through taxes. Well, most of the people in that country live out in the rural areas, never would have any use for the highways, have no reason to be using big offices. You know, the idea of having offices was that it would invite foreign investment. But foreign investment was not going to be helpful to these rural people. And yet they're the ones that have to pay the taxes to do it. And then that ended their public school system in those small villages, because there wasn't money for education. It had to go to repay these taxes. And to try to impose this model on a different society without considering how it's going to turn that society upside down is horrible. And it's bad. I don't think it's good for us here. There are people, I'm a retired teacher, and I hear over and over again how improved our education system would be if it were privatized. And it just breaks my heart, because it means there won't be schools for the ordinary person, good schools.
And I think a part of what, not that it's really related to this, but a part of what Joseph Stiglitz says is that with the sole emphasis of the IMF on keeping control of inflation, governments, local governments, are prohibited from paying attention to local needs, because the IMF has one standard from which they base all their politics on, and it's inflation. And so do whatever you want, but keep the inflation down. And sometimes that is not the best for the country. But I want to quote one more theologian, and we can talk some more.
Who was the last person you were quoting who said you have to resist the temptation to do good?
It's from Yung Mo Sung, Brazilian Korean liberation theologian.
That's not right. It was from economist from Johns Hopkins. Resist.
Yeah, but yeah, okay, but he's.
Oh, I see. He's quoting.
It's a general theory of economy. I mean, it's in. Has anyone read The Commanding Heights by Daniel Yergin and Joseph Stanislaus? It covers a lot of, it's a book that takes upon itself to look at the whole world and the history from the 40s or so on, the economic structures that have been used. It looks at China, it looks at Russia, it looks at the Asian economy, the collapse of the Asian economy, and all sorts of different places, Latin America, and the help from Milton Friedman in Chile, and all of the wonderful stories. And it has similar theories of, we have to stop trying to interfere. It looks good, you know, with immediate effect, but on long-term politics, this is not good, this is bad.
Who would you say was? Well, I just thought that the question was referring to the quote about we have to stop tinkering with capitalism because, you know, by continuing to inject socialist policies, we're preventing the natural good outcome from capitalism. That's what I thought.
Yeah, the economist that we talked about is there were F.A. Hayek, who died in 92, and Francis Fukuyama, who was an advisor for the Reagan government, and he's now a professor in Washington, Johns Hopkins. But Julio Santana, he's from Uruguay, and he's now arguably working in Switzerland as an ecumenical institute there. And he has talked a lot about the secularization of the market. He's been working with the World Council of Mission, and they've been doing a lot of work on globalization and the effects. Actually, a lot of theologians are talking about globalization. It's big. And he says, a very striking fact in the process of globalization is that the market has imposed itself on human beings. If you remember the photos we looked at yesterday, that's pretty much the images that he has. We went to the village center and looked at the photos. And he continues, if there is financial instability, men and women have to pay the price of the adjustment necessary to restore the balance. The market has become a kind of fetish. A fetish is an object that has a magical power. An object of irrational reverence or obsessive devotion. An idol, an object of passionate devotion. It has to be free, for which we absolute. And human beings are subordinate to it and its demands. To put it in another way, the global free market is not to be touched. The market is understood as something which ensures cohesion of our world, in parentheses, a natural law. And he says, as I have said, it is self-regulating. In the light of all this, it is quite true to say that the market is being sacralized, treated as something sacred. And this is why they think that theologians need to get involved in this. They need to desacralize globalization. They need to desacralize the capitalistic free market model. Because it is not working according to the gospel. It is putting people underneath the market. The market is becoming some sort of transcendent image which we cannot criticize, which we cannot touch.
Can we name some of those gospel messages that are so fundamental to calling down or identifying the idolatries of these things? Examples such as Jesus saying that a person's life does not consist in the abundance of things, and that if someone is trying to hog everything for himself, that his very life may be required of him, and then whose will it be? And if you're going to save your life, you could really have to give it away, or you will lose it.
I thought for a moment you were going to make me say. Well, I'm a systematician.
If we do not look at these from the personal and individual point of view and only talk about what theologians have to do, then that lets us all off the hook. And after all, who are the people?
Yeah.
If we are not.
No, I think they're addressing us all. You know, they're saying, hello, you know, we need to wake up and look at how are these people talking about our life, our economy, and how are they talking about us? Because if you look at the... What are human beings in this? We're looking at two theologians and their presentation of this model. I'm not saying that it's the perfect presentation, but to have something to start talking from.
I think we like the model, if you can say we, and especially in America, if you want to say that it's become sacred, mm-hmm. that the materialism of America overall really reflects that model, so they do go hand in hand. It isn't something that the pontiffs up above have just handed down to us and we've decided to mouth it, though we do. But I think that materialism is our creed. It is our first love, and it's what we worship in this country.
Maybe it makes us feel better that we're supposed to worship it, so it's okay.
So the language, I don't think, just by changing the language, isn't going to...
No.
You know, because the priority is already in our hearts. The worship is there.
But I think if we start talking about it in more honest terms, maybe we realize what,
what we're saying.
Did you say the market had become secularized or that it had been sacred?
Sacralized.
Okay. Then I don't have a question.
Okay.
I just had a comment. I'm sitting here thinking about my kids. And this notion that, the idea of idolatry and that hope for ultimate whatever, freedom, satisfaction, whatever, rests in, the accumulation of things. And I think that there's no doubt that they have that. And I mean, not that I don't as well, but I think that that part of that mythology in this country is that it's possible to get everything you want. There's a certain, and this I think that there's a way in which we're blind to a class system. The fact that most of us are not going to get a Ferrari, but my 11-year-old persists in believing that it's possible that he's going to get to have all of these things that really only baseball players or, Bill Gates or, it's highly unlikely that he will. But you can't disabuse him of that notion.
No, the myth is so strong.
It's so strong. It is
that
so
we can
strong.
All rise.
And I'm not even sure that if he lived his whole life without getting them, that he, that I think there would be a chance that some people might live their whole life not having that fulfillment and still believe it.
No, that's to me is the totally amazing thing about this country, that it seems just, no matter how pathetic people's lives are economically, they have a strong notion of the possibility of glamour.
Yeah.
Hope.
But what is wrong with not having hope of being able to raise yourself? I mean, I don't disagree with the thought process you have here, but I think you have to go halfway a little bit in that. And you have to have hope. You have to have the ability to say, I can achieve something here. And you have to be very careful that you're not crossing over a line.
But I think what the Latin Americans are coming at is this really what you want to achieve?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that gives us fulfillment?
Okay, well, let's answer
that
question.
I mean, sure, food on the table.
What do you want to achieve?
I think that's a very important question.
It is. It's a critical question.
Where is it? Where are you going?
Yeah.
I don't even think that we get a chance to ask that question.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
I think
you do
that
as an individual. You do as an individual.
Certainly.
Sure you do.
Certainly.
Every day of the week you have as an individual,
yeah.
Can you ask yourself, where am I going? What do I want?
Career question.
I think it's unreal to think that everybody only dreams about material things.
I mean, some people
But I think it's also naive to think that none of us do ever. But I think of all the people I know, and they don't just, I mean, they want maybe certain things, or they may want to improve their, or at least keep their standard of living, whatever, but they also, you know, try to do things for others, or involve in their church. Maybe as a culture we're not, but, you know, maybe the people I associate with are sort of unusual, but I don't know, I think a lot of people actually do search for something beyond that.
Well, I think that what we have to come to in a nation is that what are the goals of this country, because that acts largely through the political system. It doesn't act through the individual system.
No.
As an individual can make a difference, but the real overall policies are national policies. And if we're going to have national policies that make it possible for people to go into low-wage jobs, school systems don't train them to go beyond a certain level, you know, public schools, then that does limit what the aspirations are. Even if all of these people working at McDonald's say, someday I'm going to have a Ferrari, rationally that just isn't, it doesn't compute.
No.
And this mythology that you meant, you talk about, mythology of the free enterprise system is that everyone can have everything.
No, and it really transports. I mean, I grew up hearing that, you know, you can go to the United States, start out as a delivering newspapers, and you will become a millionaire or even a billionaire.
It even
came to us because we had people coming back from immigrants coming back on vacation, and they brought their big cars on boats. You know, all the people that ended up miserable, I mean, they couldn't afford to come back and show up, so we never met any of them.
Well, I mean, part of it too is, you know, who are the economists you're listening to?
Yeah, sure.
And to take it back to where the church should be coming from.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the big problems we have in our church today is we're afraid to talk about money.
Yeah.
And the church should be talking about money. The stewardship is so out of whack. We don't train our people in stewardship at the church. They're not going to learn stewardship with their own money. It's always for success. And from what I've been taught, to strive for success on your own is a sin. Because success comes to you through the grace of God. And if you're not striving for success that way, that's where we're getting off in this weird tangents in our capitalistic world.
And
the theologians should come in, and the churches should come in, and they can fix it.
I think what got me started on this is it was this sort of, I was really annoyed with the Danish state church. 90% of Danes are Lutherans, and we have a strong state church. And they have a policy of non-interference in society politics, and that just drove me nuts. And I think what is a danger too when you talk about church is that how much is our church involved, or churches involved in the system? They're a part of the system. It's a church and it's an institution. It has to survive economically. We have salaries to pay. Missionaries to, you know, they have a great job, but, you know, they're a cost, and how much can they be allowed to cost, and how are we going to do it, who's going to, you know, who's paid what, and there's a big discussion within the church that nobody really wants to touch. I think you're right, because we're not really supposed to talk about money. It's just grace.
Apparently the Danish church never even heard of Kierkegaard.
Well, they really, he was not that popular at home.
No, I was pretty well.
I have another comment, which is that I do think that it's important to have the conversation about the critique, because you know, we are blinded to what could be better, and I think that's really the ground and you know, on our personal action and our political action and our church action. And it's not, and I think this is hard to sort of get in here when you're trying to get at the side where there's so much wrong, is that there is a lot of power. And this goes back, you know, to the other half. I mean, capitalism does create innovation, you know, and there there is a place for the amassing of some amounts of capital, but there is a place for a critique of the over-amassing of capital. And what you were bringing up was, if the only argument is that if we remove all restraints from capitalism and have a laissez-faire economy in which the total amassing of capital is considered the greatest good, then you get a huge imbalance in the good of all peoples. And, you know, that's not going to work. And I think that that criticism needs to be looked at, you know, over and over.
If we continue a little bit with my notes, you know, for a change.
<Sorry. laughs>
Okay. I like this discussion. And I think, I just want to say that I am a revolutionary, I don't know, in some point, but what I like is that for everybody to be aware of, I think criticism is important. That's what makes society better. If we're not criticizing and just letting things sort of flow over us, we're not really being responsible citizens. And I think, yeah, everybody, you know, needs to form their own opinion, and then I'm just trying to push over. I think when the theologians oppose the language so much, I think I would like to look at that for a little bit. And I think I'll first turn to Stephen Lundquist. He's an anthropologist, and he works with myths and how you interpret myths. And he has this, I'm going to quote him. He says, "Of course, not every explanation of reality is a mythical one. So it's important to recall Iliadi." Iliadi is he works with myths. I think he's at the University of Chicago. His criterion concerning the truth value of a myth. "However, I think we should reject this claim that a myth represents the truest of truth. Instead, we can say that the defining feature of a mythical belief, as far as its value is concerned, is that it is beyond question. That is, for the person who is living in a myth, the question as to whether the story or belief is true or false is meaningless. The myth just is. In other words, it is accepted at such a deep level that we never even think about questioning it. This does not prevent people who live in a myth from asking questions about the meaning of the myth. On the contrary, discussion of such questions usually plays an important role in societies governed by a myth. The only question which cannot be asked is the basic question of whether or not the myth itself is true." So, when we talk about our economic system and we live in the myth of consumer fulfillment, we can talk about, you know, yeah, I know, I think a Mercedes is okay, you know, I can't have a Ferrari, you know, and we can talk about different things involved in the myth, but if we can't talk about whether or not we can really be satisfied through being a consumer. Or, and the larger part of the myth is, so are we talking, you know, who are we talking about when we're talking about consumers? I mean, that leaves out a great part of the world. I mean, the people living in plastic bag houses in southern Brazil, and it rains a lot sometimes, they're not a part of this consumer reality. So they're just outside of our world, because they do not fit into our myth. And I think these are questions that the theologians that I deal with, they ask, and they say, how can we break this myth so that we can become a part of, you know, society, that we can become humans as well? Because if you're a human being through consuming, we're really not, you know, we can't take that part, because the world is not divided economically so that we have anything to consume with. So that's why they want to break this myth. And this is from his book, The Myth of Kingdom and the Kingdom of the Myth. And I think if we're treating the capitalistic model like a myth, and if we are, have economists created this notion of a myth by talking about it in a way that makes us feel that there is no way around this model? This is the only truly effective way, and it's made possible for us to think that you know, hey, maybe there's still other economic models that we have never heard about, and they're still out there to be discovered. You know, if we were to liberate our minds a little bit, or maybe just me, I'm the last one to think it, but and I think another guy that has something to add to this discussion is, or about how does our religious language affect our way of thinking about economics, is Peter Berger. He's a sociologist of religion. And he talks about how a religion, this is just a religion, not any particular, but religion as an institution, or how it legitimates social structures by bestowing ontological status on them. A religion has the power to locate a human phenomenon in a cosmic frame of reference. So if we for a moment buy into the presented theory that economists do indeed use religious myths and metaphors in their presentation of their capitalistic model, this, I think, does have an enormous consequence about how do we think about the model that they present to us if they use a certain language to talk about it. So now I'd like everybody to just join the discussion about whether or not you agree on, or you see some aspects of religious structures in the way that economists talk about models, or you think it's totally wrong, or you see it having another effect on how you understand them, or talk about the myth.
Well, I think a lot has to do with how economists are just trained to measure, you know, to measure in the economy of a country. I mean, that's what their whole focus is, measuring output of a country, or joblessness, you know, numbers of people on unemployment benefits, things like that. And I mean, we always talk about economists, but I think it's more the politicians and what the economists report, and then the politicians take it and they twist it, or, you know, to their benefit, or however they want to, what message they want to give with it. And it seems like, you know, with America, it's always feel good. How do I put a spin on this to make it so it's accepted and keeps me in office?
Yeah, language is really important, how we
were. Earlier you mentioned the book Fast Food Nation. Not too long after that, when another book came out, I cannot remember the name of the author. The title is Fast Food, Fast Track. And she took the point of view of finding out who are these people who actually are working in these restaurants, in particular McDonald's and Burger King, well, those two are great. And interviewed them at great length, and reported it in a very, far more complete and thorough investigation than the other one. But her conclusion was that there are these people who she documents very intimately, who, with their eyes wide open, go into these really unsuitable jobs, almost dead-end jobs, but they live in enclaves in big cities that that support them. That is where they have a network around them, so that they can, for a period of time, they can survive on too small of an income, a pitiful income, which is what you get if you work at those places. And then use that as a way to get into the economy, the local economy of the enclave, of the neighborhood. And she had all these different ones. I'm not really good at this, but I mean, they had to do with their ethnic heritage, where they came from. And what would happen then is that ultimately the individual would either rise to a level in that particular industry that they were happy with, manager or owner, and literally one of these young men ended up owning a whole string of restaurants. And he got the boat and the car.
Yeah, I think that's the stories that makes the myth stay alive. Yeah.
But the other side of it, which is illustrated by that very book, is that there is another whole segment out there, which we don't seem to talk much about, that after a while they see that they're not going to go anywhere at all, and they become utterly disillusioned. Not only are they not going to have the car and the boat, they're going to be lucky if they can get a bicycle. And in other words, their life becomes hopeless. And parts of the American economy in big cities, is there's all kinds of people that are hopeless. And I'm way out here in the extreme, I mean, in the wilderness practically, in Tacoma. And every day, I'm a school bus driver, and every day I know of kids who it's shocking how they have no hope whatsoever economically. And they just don't care. They've already given up, and they're only in the seventh or eighth grade. And they just figure that they'll just live as long as they live, and then they'll go to hell. And that's their life. And it's pitiful. So yeah, sure, there are kids that have that hope, even at 11 years old. But I can tell you that I know some that don't. Mm-hmm. And that's a byproduct of this a very, very unfair economy. And I want to go back and say that the individual thing, I think it has a matter of the individual person that we have been duped, and this has happened over a long period of time, into putting we have swallowed the idea that what we get for ourselves is the highest good. And the idolatry is that we deserve to have a good home with lots of cars and, you know, a green lawn and all of that kind of stuff. And even though we know there are people living in plastic bag houses elsewhere because of it, that's...
I think what I, in the book, The Commanding Heights, that I mentioned before, Daniel Yergin has very interesting comment about how different culture, people from different cultures are willing to accept different levels of economic insecurity. And he says that people from the U.S. are willing to accept a lot higher level of risk than, for example, people from Northern Europe. I think it has something to do with the different myths that we're creating. I mean, I'm sure that, or I know that in Denmark there is the great myth and that we still have a welfare society, you know.
I think it also comes down to your sense of values. You have to ask yourself this question then, okay, if I live in a plastic house, will that bring up everybody else's self-esteem, and will that help everybody else? And to me, the answer to that is no.
No, and I think the question is not whether we're all going to be equally miserable,
right.
But how we can all share,
but make
the politics of the world in a way that...
But that comes to your sense of values, then.
Sure.
If you don't strive to do better for yourself, how can you help somebody else?
But the other thing that economists... I wish I could remember the name of the book, and I can't, but there was an economist who wrote a very interesting book, and I read part of it and heard a review of it, so this is a little sketchy, but he said, the problem with the way we value what we think of as primitive societies, you know, we say that there's no wealth there, because we don't measure what is really a value in that society. For instance, a little self-sufficient plot where a family can live. They can cultivate enough food to live. And then they've done that for generations. That isn't valued in the model that is used in measuring a society's economy. And that we, for instance, in this country, that when they measure even things like inflation or the models that private economists and the government economists use to decide on policies, they don't measure things in the way I would if I was going to talk about what was necessary to have a normal, average kind of life. I'm not saying this very well, but that when they say there is no inflation, and I go to the grocery store, and for $10 I come out with this little sack, you know. And I can remember a few years ago when for $10 I got enough for my family. If they say there isn't any inflation because they've taken these certain items out of what it is to be considered. So that economists, I think, are very selective about the model that they use. You read one economist and then it comes up with something different than another one does. What is the value of the little family farm, which hardly exists anymore in this country? See, it isn't considered a feasible economic base anymore. It used to be that very important, very successful.
I wanted to respond to the folks striving to get ahead, or that if we're not striving to get ahead, then like how will others be inspired to keep striving? And I would say that there are lots of folks who barely have enough money to put food on the table that are striving like mad, like we wouldn't believe. And that like they're scraping and penny pinching and working three jobs, and for one reason or another they're striving like I never knew how to strive. And so like I wanted to just say that. And then the second thing I had was I was just wondering if you were familiar with ecological economics and the work that like Sally McVeigh is starting to get into that. And it's a model that looks, coming from a Christian economist perspective, looking at how like the essence of Christianity is in community, and how what neoliberalism or capitalism does is values the individual so much that we get sort of wrapped into this individualistic myth, where if we get back into community and start thinking communally, which is really the power of Christianity to me, that we start approaching economy in a very different way too. And so there's some theologians and some economists that are starting to work on a different model to juxtapose. And then, you know, the process comes with the in-between, like how do we move from this capitalist system to one where it's more based in community. But there's folks that are starting to work on that. So that was really exciting for me to hear, because I've heard lots of critiques of this capitalist system, but have heard very few alternatives of where we could go as a Christian community and how we could live our lives in ways that were revolutionary, because that's what we're called to. So.
I think I would also like to hook on to that, that if people just work enough, that they're gonna make it eventually. I think there is a lot of poverty in the States too. There are places like Appalachia and some places in Chicago, Detroit, and everywhere.
Washington,
Georgia,
Washington. Come on, Seattle.
Everybody has an example. And as in Brazil, I think some of the people that in Brazil, many people have two jobs at least, or, you know, I have this guy coming, 13-year-old boy coming around to my house as often as he can possibly make it to sweep the sidewalk, because, you know, that's you know, as pretty much as good as he can do, and you can just hope that, you know, he maybe he'll once advance to being yard guy, or, you know, pays a little better. The level of education that's there for him, it's just not sufficient to move on. And when the system, when the public system of education is so poor, and that the push from the teachers is not enough because they're hardly getting by, I think there are so many structures that that prevents people from, even if they are struggling, that they don't have a chance to, you know, make it, as we would say. In the myth, we all know what make it means.
Make it can mean something very different to different people, too. And I think you were maybe getting at that. Someone who has maybe a small farm is maybe very happy, too. I'm not talking about someone who's, you know,
uncomfortable.
It's maybe their choice, yeah, and it's maybe a fulfilling life for them. Whereas for someone else, you know, their choice might be different. But the whole idea is that people are in those places that don't want to be, and it's the best they can do, and they're not.
And I think what the great theologian was saying is that, you know, we just don't want this model. We want another model.
Yeah.
And it's okay for you guys to have the model that seems to make you happy,
yeah,
but it's not only affecting you, because there is so much power here to push that model into every possible
right, yeah,
corner, And that people in Brazil, they're not choosing which economic model they want to use, or people in Guatemala, or they, it's pretty much told to them from other places.
That's where the politics comes in.
Getting back to what I was talking about yesterday a little bit, then what is the responsibility of the Christian world? I'm talking about anybody that is professing to be a Christian, to put economics back into a Christ-centered situation, so that we are doing things. The people that work at McDonald's are there because we put them there. We don't want to buy McDonald's if they were paying $10 an hour. We go to Burger King because they're paying $6 an hour and we can buy a cheaper hamburger.
I think we all,
you know, we want to buy the cheap product because we don't want to pay $10 an hour for somebody.
We do it at Walmart.
Yeah, or the same thing. But why, as Christians, and what is the role of Christianity in changing that model?
Or in changing,
I'd like
society,
to know that from a standpoint of how we should look at ourselves. And wouldn't that change the world if we really started practicing what we preach?
Very good last question. Time is up.
Yeah, our glasses are up.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.